No commanders.
That's right. Thanks a lot, David. So this talk is supposed to be targeted at not at particle physicists, but for the other, say, half of the audience. So I apologize to the particle physicists if they get a little bit upset with the slow pace over things you may already know. And I encourage everybody to interrupt with questions when I say something that is confusing or whatever. So the general idea, I think, behind this workshop, I'm not an organizer, so the organizers can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's to sort of develop tools that help us maximize the chances that we will discover physics beyond the standard model at present-day colliders and those upcoming colliders like the Large Hadron Collider, which will turn on in 2007. How I wanted to organize this talk was to first of all review the standard model, since many of you may have only a passing familiarity with it, what its successes are and what its deficiencies are. Then mention a few ideas beyond the standard model for what kinds of physics could cure some of the deficiencies. And I'll be very brief there. And then how to search for physics beyond the standard model. Collider physics is an important way to do it. It's the most direct way we know of, but there are also other, to put it in context, there are other ways to do this search. For example, precision measurements, or measurements or non-observation of very rare processes. And then I wanted to say a little more about about colliders themselves, the collider environment, or the general description of processes at colliders. And then finally, and this may get short shrift, so this may be more about context, but to describe a little bit about what's going on at the Collider Physics Program. So the first place to start is with the standard model. So this is the basic description of essentially all high-energy physics phenomena. And so we might call it the basic Lagrangian from which we start. Now, if I were giving a particle physics talk, I could write the whole Lagrangian down, but that doesn't seem very useful here. So let me just describe it as the Lagrangian that has been tested damn hard. And in case you have any trouble remembering this, if you scramble the letters in the standard model, you'll find that they give you this result. It wasn't very long after I heard the right talk where this was explained to me. I only take credit for making something with the L and the O. Which were left over by the anagram program that somebody else used. Okay, so we're not going to write the Lagrangian down. Instead, let's just write down, to guide the eye, the ingredients of the standard model. First of all, the constituents of matter. Of course, most matter is made of the first generation up and down type quarks in the proton and neutron, electrons, their neutrinos. And then we have the full collection of three generations of quarks, three generations of leptons. And of course, these constituents are acted on by the basic forces. Some of the forces transform one type into another. W bosons. Other forces preserve the identity of the constituents, but still act on them. For example, the photon of electromagnetism, or the Z boson, which governs neutral weak interactions. And then finally, we can add a few colors. So each quark should really come in Well, these aren't going to match, but anyway, three colors, and those are acted on by the gluons of the strong interactions. So, and we have some characteristic properties. For example, these masses generally range from on the order of an MeV to on the order of a couple hundred GeV for the fundamental constituents, except for the neutrinos. The neutrinos have sub-electron volt masses, and I may say some more about that later. The mass of the gluons, well, the gluons are never really exist as asymptotic particles, but when you're doing experiments above a few GeV, they look like they're massless. In contrast, the mass of the W is 80 GeV, and the mass of the Z is 91 GeV, much larger than the photon and gluon, which they share many features with otherwise. So let's start talking about successes. So the most important success to an empiricist is that the standard model explains all experimental data. Of course, this is not exactly true. There are always some experimental results that are slightly at odds with the standard model. And if I had to bet, I'd bet at least one of them is showing that there's something wrong with the standard model. But I wouldn't generally like to bet, at least not all of you, which one that would be. So the standard model is very successful because there are hundreds of high-energy physics measurements which it's basically in agreement with. We'll get back to neutrinos, but the masses of neutrinos are usually considered outside the standard model. But they don't cause a crisis in it in the general structure. So another equally important thing is that the standard model explains why bad things don't happen. That is, many things are very suppressed. And this is a virtue, these things are virtues of the standard model and often cause problems with extensions of the standard model. For example, there are processes where the baryon number and the lepton number change by one unit. And those would lead to decays of the proton. But this doesn't happen, at least not with a lifetime of bigger than 10 to the 33 years. Another example, the conservation of the lepton number carried by the muon can be tested in a rare decay of a long-lived neutral meson. So this thing doesn't go to, say, mu plus E minus. The probability of it going to that, as opposed to anything else, is less than 10 to the minus 11. And then here's an example of one that's allowed in the standard model. This same neutral meson can oscillate, turn into its antiparticle. The mass of the kaon is about half a GeV. This oscillation leads to a splitting in the two eigenstates of this system, and that splitting is incredibly tiny. And all of these rare processes and tiny effects are actually challenges for theories that go beyond the standard model. But, and so these are, if you like, also successes of the standard model. And then finally, well, there are lots of lists you could make, but the last one I want to write down is that it's economical and beautiful description of the gauge forces, of the way particles, matter, couples to the photons, weak bosons, and gluons. So you've all seen that it can be described as three separate groups which act on the constituents, the gluons of SU3, the quarks always transform in three-dimensional representations of SU3, so they're mixed up by the gluons. Similarly, I've shown the SU2 action here, the W's, and then the hypercharge. Here, we can give these couplings G3, G2, and G1. What actually happens here is that there's a mixing, so there's a W plus and W minus here, but the Z is a mixture and the photon is another mixture here. And this, but the basic couplings are very universal. I mean, this is the most universal diagram or coupling we have. It describes, with only changing a few color matrices and numerical factors, the couplings of quarks to gluons, of leptons to W's, and and so on. And the strength GI goes here along with some other factors. But we also have, in the case of SU3 and SU2, we have gluon self-interactions, or W self-interactions, like this. And then there's another particle, which is usually included in the standard model, the Higgs particle, which we've not detected. Of all of these particles, it's the only one that hasn't been detected yet. Perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, it's the only particle of all of those that has spin zero. Every other particle has spin a half or spin one. And so it's something we don't have a very secure feeling about. But we can write down a theory that has the same symmetries as the coupling to fermions here, the same gauge symmetry with scalars. And they will couple Higgs's to W's and Z's. And there are, with a coupling, well, call it W3. And then there are other couplings to pairs of W's with G2 squared. And the key feature of the standard model and its explanation of the W and Z masses is spontaneous symmetry breaking. And it's something that's driven by the Higgs, which, because we haven't directly detected it, we haven't really been able to test in a lot of detail. And I won't give a very long-winded explanation of it, but we have a potential for Higgs boson, which probably all seen in one form or the other, which has a quartic behavior. So V is a constant here, and V is the value that the Higgs wants to take at its minimum. When that happens, this interaction here becomes and this can be called a W boson mass. If you think of a W moving along in space when it feels the influence of this expectation of the Higgs, then it behaves like a massive particle. And so we have a description of how the W and Z gets its mass, but that's the least well tested of anything I've told you so far. And then the reason this is so economical, though, is because only one more parameter besides the strengths of the forces has to come into the game. And so we can essentially predict everything that has to do with the intrinsic forces in terms of these four parameters. Usually these are traded for other parameters. That is not so important. The strong coupling constant is like the square of g3. It's the probability that goes along with an amplitude that goes like g3. These parameters are often traded for the three most precisely measured quantities in weak interactions. There is a term that governs muon decay called the Fermi constant, which is acting like V. In fact, it is basically V. There's the mass of the Z, which is now known incredibly precisely and is a function of G1, G2. And
sorry,
too low. Okay. So, is this about the limit?
Yes.
Okay. So these are traded for these four parameters. We can trade for alpha s, for the rate of muon decay, which is usually parameterized by G Fermi, and the mass of the Z. And then you need one other parameter. And now these are starting to become of roughly equal precision. One is the electromagnetic fine structure constant. Another is a parameter that measures parity violation in Zs, sine squared theta W, and another is MW. You might say that I thought alpha EM was known to many more digits than these others. But this is the electromagnetic coupling measured in atomic processes at very long distances. What's needed here? Just checking. Anyway, it's the wrong number. 129 is the right number. That's the electromagnetic coupling at the Z scale. Anyway, so these are the basic parameters of precision physics. And in general, there's a very good fit using these parameters. There's also, I'll mention a little bit later, other parameters that enter in an auxiliary way. But we get a very good description of electroweak phenomena this way. But let's turn now to deficiencies. Okay, first of all, those of you in the planetary program have certainly noticed by now that there's no gravity in the standard model. Minor detail. So we could do what Einstein did and just put G mu nu's everywhere and make this thing generally covariant. And then we would have the standard model plus gravity at the classical level. However, we wouldn't be able to get it to work with that prescription at the quantum level. Turns out that the loops involving gravitons going around would be generally out of control. So the situation with gravity and relativistic quantum mechanics is not so simple. But of course there are potential solutions. Another big can of worms is the flavor puzzle or puzzles. There are many different ways to count some of these things. Particle physicists usually call flavor the different types of quarks or leptons, the different generations. So you might say that this chart here, which has interactions here and across in color, is sort of begging for interactions to move you this way. And we really don't see much in the way of these interactions, except through the, essentially through the Higgs boson, but that's the piece we really understand the least. So the real question is why three generations given especially that all stable matter is made out of this column here. And once we've decided that, yes, there are three generations, then we have to account for the fact that while the gauge structure was very economical in parameters, there are many parameters in the flavor sector. Let's start counting them. There's for each of the six quarks over there, there are masses. Now the charged W bosons, I lied a little bit. They don't exactly, well, couple this one to this one. They couple, if I call UI, the collection U, C, and T, and DJ, the collection DSB. There's actually a matrix going in here, which, so we have six from the masses. This matrix is called the Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix, and it turns out to have three real entries. That's easy to remember, because if you were just thinking about real rotations, there are obviously three of them. But then there's a one irreducible phase in this matrix. That is, it starts out its life as a complex matrix, but there are certain redundancies in the complex phases. You can rotate these fields too. And when you're all done, you get a special phase that violates a combination of charge and parity, which is important, and we'll get to later. There's also, in the quark, in the lepton sector, there are three more parameters. And finally, recently, the number of parameters has had a big upward adjustment with the discovery that neutrino masses are non-zero. And I'm getting close to the bottom of the line, which I shouldn't have erased. But anyway, there are three more masses of neutrinos, E, mu, and tau neutrinos. And then there's a new matrix, which I can't quite remember all of the initials, but I think it's called the MNSP matrix. And it has three real, and actually has three more phases in it. So if we want to look for a simple theory, we have all these parameters to explain, and it's a real challenge. So let's see, I've gotten to sort of two main puzzles. There's another one, which is a bit off on the side from many lines of investigation, but might be a useful clue. There's a strong CP problem. The Lagrangian for QCD, I'll write it in non-covariant notation, so maybe it looks a little more familiar to students of Maxwell. It's basically a color trace over E squared minus B squared. But then there's another term you could write down, which has an E dot B interaction, where these are all color electric and color magnetic fields. And this thing here would produce a electric dipole moment for the neutron, which hasn't been observed. And based on that, this parameter, which is written with a theta to let you know it should run from 0 to 2 pi, actually has to be less than about 10 to the minus 9. So that's a puzzle. Why is this CP violating angle so tiny? And another deficiency is that it has no dark matter candidate. Every particle we've observed, the heavier they get, the faster they decay. Anything of order 100 GeV, a TeV or so, should decay extremely quickly, unless there's some good reason we haven't found in the standard model. Even the Higgs, we don't know that much about it, but it certainly shouldn't be live more than a nanosecond. So that's, I don't know, I'm up to about number four on the list of deficiencies. Let me make one more. So this one, of course, has very interesting astrophysical and cosmological consequences. Let me mention one other one, which is that the standard model does not have a way to make a big enough too small by many orders of magnitude baryon asymmetry. So, of course, in the universe today, all the planets and other things we've seen are, we think, made out of baryons. That doesn't mean that baryons are really copious. There are microwave photons, which are much more numerous. So this ratio is only of order 10 to the minus 8. On the other hand, most people think that most particle physicists anyway, think there was a very early period of inflation. That is, you could ask, maybe this asymmetry was set at the very beginning. But if the universe went through a period of inflation, there are like 60 E foldings, which would have basically decreased just about any asymmetry to zero. And so what we'd prefer is a way of taking the conditions right after inflation with a baryon fraction of essentially zero and getting up to something like 10 to the minus 8. Now, this doesn't sound like a big challenge, but in fact, we don't know how to do it in just the physics of the standard model at up to around the TeV scale. And there were three conditions that were set out by Sakharov for what you needed to do to generate a baryon asymmetry with an initial zero asymmetry. And the three ingredients that you need is, first of all, you need to violate baryon number. That's pretty obvious. If you start with no net baryon number and want to end with net baryon number, you should violate it. That's assuming you can't segregate it into patches, which seems generally hard to do. The second ingredient is that you must violate charge asymmetry, which relates baryons to antibaryons. If every process that has a baryon going one way has exactly the same rate as an antibaryon, then starting with symmetric conditions, you won't get out of equilibrium. Actually, charge symmetry is violated quite strongly in the weak interactions, along with parity. But their combination is exchanging charge and parity. And since there's nothing particularly asymmetric in the conditions in the early universe, CP is a second required condition. And this is another one that's very hard for the standard model to fulfill. And the third one is that you have to get out of thermal equilibrium. So the question is, how does the standard model fare on these three conditions? Now, we've seen that the proton lives for 10 to the 33 years, and you might have thought that if the standard model accommodates that, then it also should not have any significant baryon number at all. But it turns out that's not true. And actually, at high temperature, there is a significant baryon number violation in the standard model. And the reason is a bit subtle, but we could, let me just try to give a heuristic explanation. If we wanted to ask about the conservation of electric charge, then we have, remember our diagram here with a photon, so it couples to electric charge, whether it's in the form of up quarks, down quarks, electrons, etc. And you might worry that, if you thought about things the right way, that this that this charge conservation could be spoiled by certain terms which actually have this E dot V structure we were just talking about, but for the weak bosons. And to assess that, you might draw a diagram like this. You would have a photon coming in. This is weighted by the charge, so everything happening here is going to affect the charge conservation. And you would have a few W's coming out. And if you took the right configurations, you could get this E dot B. So it turns out that there's a delicate cancellation between the quarks and the leptons in these graphs, so that the coefficient in front of here is zero. Okay? But if you instead write down something, we'll just call it V, it's not a real particle, but instead of putting the electric charge here, you put the baryon number. So you only have up and down quarks with equal weighting. You find that, this is non-zero. And so there's actually a violation of baryon number, which is, in fact, equal to a corresponding violation of lepton number, where we instead circulate the neutrinos and the leptons in the loop. And they're both proportional to some number times this combination of weak fields. Now this combination is very subtle. It doesn't lead to any non-negligible effects at zero temperature, but configurations like this can get excited in the thermal universe. And in fact, you can get quite rapid transitions that violate baryon number and lepton number together in the standard model. The place the standard model has trouble is in the CP violation and in the departure from thermal equilibrium. I mentioned that the CP violation in the standard model is all attributed to one phase delta. If you repeated the same exercise in the standard model with only two generations instead of three, you would find that it's not there. So one potential answer, although the details haven't been worked out, for why there are three generations is to allow the standard model mechanism of CP violation to produce some kind of baryon asymmetry. In any case, the fact that there's a phase for three generations but no phase for two generations means that whenever you're in a situation where you can sort of ignore or remove some extra phases, you get zero. This is kind of a hand-waving explanation, but most effects from CP violation actually require extra suppression factors of masses and other mixing angles, which we know are kind of small. And I'm only writing a few of these down, but there are a number of these factors, and they lead to very large suppressions, which already make it hard to make baryons in the standard model. But then the last reason is that there's this question of thermal equilibrium. And if you want to try to make baryons, one, you have to get out of equilibrium. And in the standard model, the only way to do that is to have a situation where the universe underwent a phase transition at a temperature of order the W and Z masses, 100 GeV. In fact, we know by calculating the thermal effects that the universe is governed by the standard model does undergo such a phase transition. So here's a sketch of what the Higgs potential looks like as a function of the Higgs field at large temperature. And then at lower temperatures, it goes through a place where it's more like instead of a quadratic potential, it's a quartic potential. And then finally, it looks like it has the zero temperature behavior. But what happens is that the vacuum, the place where the Higgs wants to sit, just smoothly moves across to here. And there's no discontinuous change in the conditions that take you out of thermal equilibrium. This is a result of some detailed calculations and important input from colliders. And it happens for something like MH bigger than about 60 GeV. This is the right picture. And we know that the actual experimental limit is more like 115 GeV. What you would need to get out of thermal equilibrium is a different picture, something like this. So that you can come down, sit here, and then at some point you can thermally activate or maybe nucleate a quantum transition and jump discontinuously. If you can do that, you can get out of equilibrium. But that doesn't happen in the standard model with the parameters that we've been set. It could happen in extensions of the standard model. Okay, so there are other issues, but the most pressing issue is one that is called the fine-tuning or the hierarchy problem. Any questions so far? So this is a peculiarity that comes when you compute quantum loops for the Higgs boson. And it doesn't tend to happen for any of the other particles. You can have, for example, the Higgs coupling to a top quark. Or this is the same graph that we use to give the W its mass. These corrections turn out to give a mass shift. That is, they adjust the mass of the Higgs from what you originally wrote it down as, and they have a form with an integral over the four components of space, and they have only a 1 over p squared in the denominator. So you can see by scaling, this is going to have the form. So this is a dimensionful energy scale, so many GeV or TeV, and it leads to a shift of the Higgs mass of order that whatever that cutoff is, squared. Now you can remove this divergence, like many other divergences in quantum field theory, by resetting the parameters. But the point is, you have to set this one parameter extremely precisely if you think that lambda is, say, 10 to the 13th or 10 to the 15th GeV, the gut scale. Even if you only think it's a TeV, you have to set it to pretty high accuracy. So the original gauge hierarchy problem was the question of whether how much do we have to tune things if lambda is a scale that, for various reasons, people thought was an incredibly high scale. Then if the mass of the Higgs, for other reasons, is of order a TeV, you have to tune to 24 orders of magnitude or so. Nowadays, people are worrying about a little hierarchy problem, since we haven't done many direct experiments at 10 to the 15th GeV. We can still, though, look at what we have tested experimentally. So here's the kind of test you can do. You can look at E plus E minus goes to E plus E minus, and that will have a contribution from where these particles annihilate into a virtual photon and maybe some other contributions. And then you ask, what happens if everything goes haywire at a scale lambda? these parameters, the effect of this photon is suppressed as you go to higher energies. So you can do this test as incisively as possible at very high energies. This one turns out to go just like 1 over lambda squared. So you can do these tests at a couple hundred GeV, but with very good precision, so that these lambdas, as determined from here, are greater than or of order a few TeV, typically. On the other hand, we have some evidence of roughly where the Higgs should be. There is a kind of indirect bound that the Higgs mass should be less than of order a TeV, which roughly comes because the Higgs and the W are tied together. I should have said this earlier, but the moment you make a gauge particle massive, you need three spin states. That's just because when it's massive, you can bring it to rest. When you can bring it to rest, you have three rotations. So if you have it spinning in one direction, it must be also possible to spin it in the x and y direction as well as the z direction. On the other hand, you know that photons have only two spin states, the two plane or circular polarizations. So the extra spin state is provided by the Higgs boson. And what that means is that the Higgs boson can play a role in, this is very rough, but it's possible to devise probabilities that would be greater than one, except for the additional exchange of the Higgs mass. And roughly speaking, that suggests that the Higgs shouldn't be much more than a TeV. But on the other hand, we can do even better than this, because we have from experiment, if we do precise enough experiments, we can actually see quantum loops involving the Higgs as well. By comparing the W and the Z masses, we can construct observables that go like the logarithm of the Higgs mass. It's unfortunate that it's the logarithm, so you have to work very hard to get a good bound on the Higgs, but after a lot of hard work, the Higgs mass, from taking the standard model seriously, computing these loops, and comparing to experiment, is a limit of around 200 GeV. So since this is around 2 or more TeV, we have a factor that is, we sort of have to explain a fine-tuning to the order of 1% or so. So that suggests to people that we should be looking for new physics. New physics can be a substitute for the ultraviolet cutoff. It's a way of modifying these integrals so that you can make sense out of them, or could be. And that is that's where a lot of the ideas that the new physics should be just around the corner. That is around. Yeah. Question.
You know about the lifetime of the Higgs or possible lifetime.
Okay.
Relative mass.
So in the standard model, the properties of the Higgs are well known. The lifetime is so short that you'll never see it directly. Instead, it's a broad resonance. And how broad it is depends an awful lot on its mass. So if the mass of the Higgs has a strong coupling, it would really like to decay to a pair of W's, because this coupling is a gauge coupling, which is not too different from one. So if it can decay like that, its width, once it gets above 200 GeV, can be few or 10 GeV in width, so fairly broad. If it's less than 2 MW, say around this, just above the limit, 115, then it's on the order of a few MeV. So it's much narrower, but it's still, you know, not a macroscopic decay length. Any other questions?
Lens, how much of what you said about the Higgs would be modified with the, like, lots of Higgs, except this one?
Well, the if you had a, there are definitely examples of extensions of the standard model which don't have to solve the hierarchy problem in one fell swoop. You could have a 2 or 3 Higgs doublet model, and it may be that you would say that once you get to the scale above where all those Higgses come in, the same problems will come back. In contrast, that there are other theories that modify the interactions to remove this problem. So one example would be, say, supersymmetry. And another would be, could be, if the Higgs were not an elementary particle, but a spin zero bound state, like we think of the pi zero as a spin zero bound state of quarks. It's probably a different kind, but that's another example. Any other questions? So, examples of theories beyond the standard model. Well, I mentioned one of them already, which is supersymmetry. And the nice thing about supersymmetry is if I left this up long enough, I can put all of the new particles expected on here just by drawing tildes. And what that means is that for every spin a half particle that we've already observed, there's a new spin zero particle that has not yet been observed, which is denoted there. Similarly, all the spin one particles are related to spin a half particles. And so those are called gluinos, winos, photinos, etc. So at the price of doubling the spectrum, that is, that there's a new symmetry that changes spins by half units, you can remove this fine tuning. So now delta mh squared is cut off, and it becomes just a number multiplying the masses of these new supersymmetric particles. So we don't think this supersymmetry is exact, otherwise the mass of the photino would have had to be the same as the mass of the photon, and we haven't seen any massless spin a half particles. But we imagine that all the masses of the superpartners are of order the TeV scale. And then if this number is right, we can more or less accommodate the Higgs mass. And the critical thing here is that loops from fermions, like this one I drew before, gets canceled by loops involving scalars. So the top quark in a loop gets canceled by the stop in a loop, which actually has a couple of diagrams. And so this integral then ends up being of order p to the fourth instead of p squared once you get it to momenta way above these new particle masses. And so you could also say this another way. You could say that the mass of the Higgs boson gets related to the mass of its supersymmetric partner, the Higgsino. And fermion masses are typically much better protected. If you do the calculation in QED of the electron mass, you find that mass is always proportional to the mass of the electron again. And so if you set the mass to be small to begin with, then you have an understanding of why the mass can stay small. So supersymmetry is sort of, it's almost ideal for explaining the gauge hierarchy problem. But it's not a perfect theory. It has at least the plain vanilla version of supersymmetry. It has flavor problems. And this comes back to many of these processes I discussed earlier, rare decays and so on. So one of the worst ones is proton decay. So an interaction that's allowed by supersymmetry is when an up and all the other symmetries of the standard model is when an up and a down type quark annihilate into an anti-down quark. And then that one can split into a U-bar and a positron. These guys can go and make a neutral pi zero. And if you calculate the lifetime for this, it's for this guy being about a TeV, it's somewhere on the order of a microsecond. So that's close, but it's only off by a factor of 10 to the 46 from the experimental limit. So this has to be cured, clearly. And the traditional solution, which in fact makes this problem into a virtue, is to impose a symmetry called R parity. And R parity is very simple. It just says that all of these new guys have R equals minus 1, whereas the standard model particles all have R equals plus 1. So when you impose that, it turns out you forbid this single production of a new particle, and you cure this problem. And, well, at least you can delay the problems with proton decay by many, many orders of magnitude. And it has a big virtue as well, which is you have to pair produce new particles, because everything you send in has positive R parity. And so you have to make two of them at a time if they carry negative R parity. And then once you've produced a squark, say, with R equals minus 1, it can spit off a lot of standard model particles, but there always has to be some particle at the end of the day which carries R equals minus 1, which can't decay to anything else. I mean, I've oversimplified a little bit, but basically there's something called the lightest supersymmetric particle, which could be a dark matter candidate. So that's a very attractive possibility. But that doesn't solve all flavor problems with supersymmetry. There are also, even once you've imposed R parity, there are lots of other problems. Remember this K0 bar oscillation, where I said it's like 10 to the minus 12 MeV mass splitting? You understand that in the standard model, because you can compute it. You send in an S, and through a couple of W exchanges, you can turn this into a D, and it goes like alpha weak to the fourth. The problem is that in the supersymmetric standard model, you can draw similar graphs with gluinos here and squarks here. And these go like the strong interactions. And this is maybe four to the fourth times bigger or something. Depends on the masses of the gluinos versus the W. But basically, you find that this is going to overwhelm the experimental limit unless you do something tricky. Either you need all of these six squarks to be very degenerate, that is, their masses are almost identical, or you have to somehow align them, that is, their eigenstates should be vectors in a three-dimensional space which are very parallel to the quark. So either case, you have to tune these parameters to of order percent level too. There are ways to understand this, but they involve different layers of structure. I should mention that Suzy has a second cosmological virtue, potentially, besides the dark matter candidate, in that it can potentially generate enough baryon asymmetry at the electroweak phase transition. First of all, the Higgs sector is a lot more complicated. There are multiple Higgs bosons. You can find regions in parameter space where the supersymmetric theory looks like it undergoes one of these first order phase transitions where things change abruptly. So then you can get a situation. So for the baryon asymmetry, you can have a region where you start making bubbles. Outside the bubbles are the region where the W's are massless. Inside the bubbles are closer to what we see in our world, where the W's have a positive mass. And there's a wall that separates the two regions. And in this wall, the Higgs boson is changing. If I take a slice of this wall and plot it here as a function of the radius, and somewhere there's a place where the Higgs boson goes between 0 and V. Well, there are many Higgs bosons, but there's a wall made out of them. And there are additional CP-violating phases in the standard model, so that the CP violation isn't nearly as subtle as it is in the standard model. Supersymmetry allows that when you send tops and anti-tops into this wall, you can actually segregate them. And you can put more tops inside here and more anti-tops out here. Then what happens is that the baryon number violation, which occurs over here, wipes out these guys. And you're left with an excess of baryons on the inside. So there's at least the potential, if all the parameters work out right, to explain the baryons at the electroweak scale in theories beyond the standard model. But probably one of the best evidences in favor of supersymmetry is from coupling unification. The couplings in the standard model depend on the scale. So we usually call them alpha I. And they depend on the energy scale, just as we were discussing, that the alpha QED at the Z scale is not exactly the same as that at zero. And you can run the couplings back if you run them this way as 1 over alpha. And you do it in the standard model, you get curves that look like this. So this is the strong interactions, the weak in the electromagnetic, and they don't meet. But the slopes of these lines are determined by all the particles that carry charge under these groups. And in supersymmetry, you've added a large number of different particles. And when you redo the calculation there, you get pretty much agreement. So, except I drew the lines wrong. But anyway, if you drew them right, you would find that that there is a common scale to with order a couple percent that the couplings come together. So this is a clue in favor of supersymmetry, but whether it's really definitive, we can't say at this point. We really need to have some direct evidence for supersymmetry. I wanted to briefly mention one other variant so as not to leave you the impression that supersymmetry is the only possibility, and that's the idea that there might be relatively large extra dimensions. So, in fact, extra dimensions are one of the few firm predictions of string theory. String theory predicts that there are 10 dimensions in the world. And so the real question is, where are the missing 6 dimensions? And what if a few of them were actually, quote, macroscopic? What does macroscopic mean? Could some of these have R ranging from millimeters, a radius, from millimeters up to, or down to, an inverse of a TeV, where we might be able to see them at colliders? What does it mean to have extra dimensions? Or the radius of an extra dimension?
How you might invoke this to get rid of your phases that are hanging around at the time. But what does it mean to say a dimension has a size, 1 millimeter?
So
what's the size of the dimensions like a millimeter?
So we say that those are uncompactified dimensions. They're essentially infinite. But it is possible for the extra dimensions to have a different feature, that they're periodic. I mean, the universe that we know might be periodic on extremely large scales. But it's the simplest thing to think about in terms of extra dimensions is that the extra dimensions are periodic on a small scale. So it's just the fact that a drinking straw, very long drinking straw, looked at from far enough away, looks like a one-dimensional object. But when you get closer, it looks like a two-dimensional object. And it's critical to have the radius small to do that. So what happens then is that if you look at the flux lines, which determine how the force laws are going to behave, you find that there's a transition, because when you're in the limit where the drinking straw looks very thin, the flux lines are behaving like as if the space has the lower dimensionality. But when you get close enough, when you bring your test objects in here to distances r that are less than the radius, then suddenly the flux law flux is falling faster. So if you have let's take the case of gravity. Gravity in 4 dimensions has the behavior of Newton's law, where particle physicists usually like to write everything as a mass scale, so they write the Newton's constant as 1 over m Planck squared. And we know it falls off like 1 over r in 4 dimensions. But if we had delta extra dimensions, then it would fall off like some other scale, which we don't quite know yet, but we know it would fall off like 1 over r to the 1 plus delta. Okay? Just like you go from 1 over r to the 0 in 2 dimensions, well, that's really a logarithm, to 1 over r in 3 dimensions, you go to 1 over r squared in 4 spatial dimensions, and so on. Now, that's only true when you're inside here. Once you get for distances bigger than r, then these flux lines transit over, and what you find is that you get 1 over r again. You had to, but now you get weighted by 1 over r to the delta. So you can write an equation that says that r So what does this equation mean? Well, you could try to not exactly solve the hierarchy problem, but transform it as follows. You could say, what happens if m star is of order a TeV? So it could be that the Planck mass is not a fundamental mass, but it's just built. So we have a relation here that says that the Planck mass is just determined by some other more fundamental mass in a higher dimensional theory and a radius. And it could be that this isn't so enormous after all. It's just that the radius is quite enormous. So if you make R large, you could get this to work. And what you find depends on delta. If you plug in delta equals 1, you get R is bigger than the radius of the solar system. So that doesn't sound too promising. But as soon as you go to delta equals 2, then you get that R is equal to a millimeter. For delta equals 3, it's 0.1 nanometers. As it goes to infinity, you end up getting 1 over a TeV, so way sub Fermi. So this case is kind of interesting because it says you might be able to modify the forces on the millimeter scale. Now, we know you can't do that for the gauge forces because we have tested them way below the Fermi scale. But for gravity, it's not so clear. It's very hard to test gravity on these scales. So this led to a flurry of tabletop experiments that tried to look for deviations from gravity here. But the basic setup that would allow gravity to be modified, but not the other forces, is as follows. Let's take this straw and kind of look at it as an end view. And let's imagine there's a defect on the straw and that all of the particles, photons, electrons, W's, and gauge bosons have to be trapped on this defect called a brain. And this is motivated from string theory, where such objects actually appear. Then the forces for the normal, or the forces that particle physicists deal with, obey the normal behavior. This is a space-time of 4 on here, whereas only gravity emerges to have to behave as if it were in d equals 5 or 6 or whatever, probably more like 6 or 7. So that kind of picture is a possible one, and you can constrain it somewhat from tabletop experiments in this case, but for cases like this, for cases beyond delta equals 2, then it's harder to think of non-collider experiments to probe it. So in my last minus 15 minutes, the idea was to discuss a little bit how to search generally, but I was going to discuss a little bit about, if people have time to stick around, a little bit about colliders and the collider environment. So should I say a few more words, or would this be a time to wrap up?
Do you
talk about colliders?
Yeah.
So this, I think it's sort of gotten the standard model and possible. So colliders themselves can be
the next. So the only problem is I'm not here.
No, we can ask them. Sure.
Yeah, okay.
That was a question, so what's.
Okay. I can take a hint. I'll tell you a few brief words about colliders. I'll tell you about the gross features of colliders, and maybe somebody should do more justice to the more of the details of the program. But so the gross features of colliders are very easy to sketch. There are basically two types of colliders. This is the, and these are drawn roughly to scale. So this is 9 kilometers, and this is about 3 kilometers. So This is the last in a sequence, perhaps the last in a sequence, of increasingly energetic colliders. And the two things you need to know about colliders is that we have very few stable particles we can make collisions out of. And so the two options are E plus E minus and proton. Or these are the ones that sort of get you to the highest energy. And the two cases have sort of different histories and limiting features. The case for proton colliders is limited by the magnetic fields that you can achieve, because the bending radius for a particle of energy E, if you can line the entire ring with magnetic field strength B, is this form. So basically, if you want to achieve a certain energy for physics reasons, you go find out how big a magnet you can make, and that tells you how big the ring is going to have to be. In contrast, the case for E plus E minus is limited by a completely different reason. That is the power lost due to synchrotron radiation. So when you try to bend a charged particle, it radiates photons. This goes like E over M to the fourth divided by R. And so as you try to go to bigger energies, in this case, you only linearly have to increase the radius. In this case, you have to increase it by the fourth power if you want to keep this constant, or maybe quadratically to minimize things. In any case, circular storage rings for electron-positron, you're very rapidly killed by the power losses. This mass is the mass of the electron, of course, in the electron case. And because of the mass ratio of order 1,000, it's not a problem at all for protons, even when it's killing you for electrons. So this outermost ring here was probably the last energy frontier E plus E minus ring to be built, which was LEP, which had two phases, one where the some of the energies was equal to mz, or about 100 GeV, and another one where it went to 200 GeV. But they basically ran out of ability to go to higher energy because of the problems of replacing all of that synchrotron radiation. And so that's probably the end of the line for circular E plus E minus rings. So that program is now has been shut down, and the same tunnel is being filled with large superconducting magnets for the LHC, and reaching this the total energy in this case will be 14 TeV. Meanwhile, I mean, even before this ring was constructed, this is roughly to scale. The Tevatron is the current highest energy machine, and its total energy is 2 TeV. The other topology shown down here has basically the idea is to make head-on beams of particles collide, and you use electrons and positrons because of the inability to make higher energy storage rings. There's one such machine that has run, which was at SLAC. Due to technical problems like the lack of a second LINAC, the same line was used twice. So so that was able to reach about 100 GeV. And to summarize, at the proton energy frontier, we have the LHC and nothing too much else on the near horizon. And in the electron frontier, we would like to go to of order 1,000 GeV, 1 TeV. And that requires a machine that looks something like this, or about 30 kilometers or so, and much straighter than that. So the linear feature avoids most of the synchrotron radiation, except right at the collision where the bunches are severely affecting each other. Another way to compare things is in energy is by the true energy going into the collisions, but there the difference between say 14 and the 1 TeV is not as great. The picture of an E plus E minus collision is really quite clean. And most of the energies that have been investigated so far, there's like a single process that the electron and positron annihilate into a virtual photon, and then out come either a pair of quarks or a pair of mu's or something like this. So, and furthermore, almost all the energy of the electron goes into the collision you're interested in. In contrast, in a proton collision like PP, we have to compensate for the fact that these protons are composite objects. They're made up of up quarks, down quarks, and in fact, there are also gluons inside them. So the typical picture that's drawn is of two protons colliding. It was once called, I think by Feynman maybe, you have these two beautiful Swiss watches, and you want to know what they're made up of. So the thing you do is you throw them at each other as hard as you can to see what's going on. That's a hadron-hadron collision. So you have a picture where the protons are really like a beam, a searchlight, containing quarks and gluons. And in a given proton-proton collision, every now and then you'll sample a pair of quarks and anti-quarks, or quarks and gluons, and those will get close enough to each other to behave more or less like electrons and positrons. For example, the quark and anti-quark can annihilate into a Z boson. And but before they do that, they can undergo many other sort of branching behaviors. If you like, these processes here are sort of in the femto universe. They are what the Feynman diagrams that people use to compute transitions between quarks and leptons work at distances much less than a Fermi. But before you can get into this femto universe, you have to allow for dressings of these states both before you get in and after you get out. For example, on the way out, if you have a quark coming out of a collision, you get suppose you have a pretty clean, something that's fairly easy to describe, a pair of quarks coming from a Z boson decay. What you see in the detector is a number of these well collimated tracks of hadrons coming out. You never see the quarks. You see pions, the occasional proton and kaon, and so on. And this is a picture that you see experimentally, whereas theoretically, the sort of picture you have, if you, at the lowest order possible, is this up quark and this anti-up quark. And you need to build up a picture that's closer to this by putting in successive corrections from gluons. So one aspect of the program here is sort of developing the tools to deal with this femto universe, where you can successively correct this picture. There are also other tools that are needed to go to a more detailed picture of exactly where the hadrons go. And for doing that, that's another aspect of the workshop. So this is, we could call something like Feynman diagrammatics. And that itself is decomposed into many different types of special techniques. But then to emerge all the way from the femto universe, all the particles that come out of here, to connect them to the observed hadrons, there's a more empirical, I mean, some of it is based on first principles behavior, but there are actually statistical programs that allow you to take particles that you see at the Fermi level and make them split in ways that reproduce the more detailed structure of these jets. So obviously, I didn't get into a very complete description of what's going on in the collider program, but I think the general theme is that by trying to get sort of more accurate predictions of the gross structure of these collisions, and also other aspects include trying to get a more improve the predictions at the hadron level as well, we can try to firm up the predictions of the standard model to the extent that when we see deviations from it, we can be confident that they really represent some physics beyond the standard model. So I probably tried your patience enough, so thanks.